This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome, everyone, to the Comparative Ethnic Studies lecture series. This lecture series is organized by the English department, but we also have many co-sponsors. We thank Africana Studies and Research Center, the American Studies Program, the Department of Comparative Literature, Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies Program, Latino Studies Program, the Rose Goldson Lecture Series, and the Society for the Humanities. This lecture series is shaped around three inquiries: Latina and African American comparisons, the issue of diaspora, and Native American and African American comparisons. Please come to the same place at the same time next week for the second lecture. But we are delighted that Deborah Paredes is giving today's opening lecture. Her phenomenal work has re-energized the field of performance studies and performance studies approaches to issues of race and gender. My colleague, Mary Pat Brady, a professor of Chicana and Latina literature, film, and culture, will now give the full introduction of our speaker. Thanks, Maya.
Thank you, everybody, for coming today. If early last year you had said to me that a book about Celina Quintanilla would be the most important and most perceptive book in the field of Latino studies to be published within the last decade or so, I would have said, look, Celina was cool, and Deborah Paredes has that great crossover article, and Deb Vargas has that piece on Celina and drag, and Raul Coronado has that essay that I always teach, but that important? Nah. But I would have been very wrong. Professor Paredes' incredible text, Salinidad, Celina, Latinos, and the Performance of Memory, published by Duke University Press in 2009, offers, to my mind, the strongest analysis of the formation of Latinidad in a neoliberal era yet to appear. Trenchant, thoughtful, superbly and eloquently written, this text is a model of performance studies at its insightful and provocative best. Moreover, or as I have been saying to myself as I have read the book and thought about it, move over Jose Munoz and Fred Moten, there's a new girl in town. My point is that this is a text that takes up the particulars of Celina's artistry, the complications of her receptions at various points, but links them and thinks about them, not simply on their own terms, though that too is worthwhile, and the book does that superbly, but it also considers the production of Celina as a part of a process of examining the emergence of Latinidad as a broader circuitry, as an index of various structures of feelings, as a signal of national and transnational efforts at mediation and valuation, as the ambivalent site for community formation, as a zone of nostalgia and state-sponsored aesthetic projects. Celinidad is a model of the scholarship the field aspires to, and so we are very lucky today to have an opportunity to hear its author discuss her new research. Professor Paredes is also an impressive poet, a dedicated teacher, and an important community presence in Austin, with a PhD from Northwestern University, and currently she holds a position as professor in UT Austin in their theater and performance studies program, and soon their English department. She has published one book of poetry already, This Side of Skin, and is working on a second. Please join me in welcoming Deborah Paredes.
Wow, that's a completely humbling introduction. Thank you so much, Mary Pat. It's always hard when the book comes out, and as I was telling Mary Pat, you kind of hear the sort of dead air for a while when you get a book out, especially in academic circles. So to hear the feedback is wonderful, and especially to hear such generous ones. Thank you. I also want to thank Margot Crawford for inviting me to be part of this series. I'm just thrilled to be in such a stellar lineup. And Karen Kuje, did I do it right? Okay, good. For attending to all the logistical details. And then I finally want to thank someone who's not here, a friend of mine, Daniel Alexander Jones, who is also a performer, who first introduced me to the performance I'm going to talk about today that Lena Horne did on the Judy Garland show several years ago, and I've been sort of itching to write about it since. I'm eager to have the opportunity to get feedback today, and so I'm really, it's a very brand new work, so please feel free to share your insights. The talk today that I'm going to be presenting is drawn from a larger process, project that I'm working on and process called Turn It Out, Divas in America, Rita Moreno, Lena Horne, La Lupe, and La Belle. On April 9th, 1962, in Santa Monica, California, Rita Moreno accepted the Best Supporting Actress Oscar for her role as Anita in West Side Story, beating out the heavily favored Judy Garland at the 34th Annual Academy Awards, aired live on ABC. While Garland lay languishing from kidney failure at the Carson Tahoe Hospital, Moreno made history that night as the first Latina ever to win an Oscar. The following year, Lena Horne also made a memorable appearance on the small screen when she was featured as the headlining guest on the fourth episode of the short-lived but now legendary The Judy Garland Show that aired on CBS on October 13, 1963. By this time, both Moreno and Horne had already established themselves as astonishingly talented and resilient performers who occupied the unenviable position of being among the first women of color to gain recognition and a regular paycheck from Hollywood. Their personas and talents were thus often cast within the discourse of exceptionalism, racialized women who were sought after as both consumable synecdoche for and exception to their respective race. At first glance, these two moments seem representative of their secured status as palatable exotics with mainstream appeal. But by the early 1960s, both women were also known for expressing strident critiques of the representational constraints that framed their roles in film and on stage within the Jim Crow era, each having been signed with MGM in the 40s and abruptly dropped by the studio in the early 1950s. A closer look at Moreno's performance of Anita in West Side Story and Horne's appearance on the Judy Garland show within the context of the civil rights movement and the genre conventions within which they performed reveals the ways that each diva, through gesture, voice, comportment, tempo, stillness, and choreographic virtuosity, worked to loosen the screws fastening them to racialized and sexualized display, and ultimately staged models for defiant citizenship. In what is now regarded as the iconic rooftop dance scene from the film version of West Side Story, the young Puerto Rican men and women of the Sharks debate the merits and failings of America. The arguments fall conspicuously along gender lines, with the men expressing a nostalgic longing for their island home and a sharp critique of the structures of racism that circumscribe their lives in New York City, while the women praise the industrial and technological advancements available in their new home. This scene stages the larger debates about and among Puerto Ricans concerning their fraught positioning in the U.S. as both citizens and colonial subjects. The musical debate is led by Bernardo, the Sharks' leader, and his irrepressible girlfriend, Anita, a role made famous by Chita Rivera on stage in 1957 and by Rita Moreno in the 1961 film. As a result of this gender debate, the scene is commonly evoked as an emblem of sexist and racist depictions of immigrant Latinas as agents of assimilation and easily colonized subjects. But the scene is just as frequently, and often simultaneously, lauded for Moreno's charismatic, uncontainable, and virtuosic performance. Moreno's bodily migrations and her portrayal of Anita, and the character's narrative mobility within the story, express pleasurable possibilities for and a productive ambivalence central to Latino claims to citizenship in the United States. Anita's lyrics may express containment within the discourse of immigrant assimilation, but her body refuses to be contained by either traditional choreography or the spatial and racial divides that propel the musical's narrative. Within the world of the musical, Anita's difference is marked not just racially, but spatially and choreographically as well. Although audiences are first introduced to Anita as a witty and commanding big sister figure to Maria in the dress shop, it is at the gymnasium dance and on the apartment building rooftop where spectators begin to understand the significance and power of her character. Anita moves. Her ability to move in ways that traverse every corner of the stage or frame signals her position as both of the group and apart from it. Unlike Maria, whose choreography is confined to a rather two-dimensional ballet vernacular, Anita occupies a fuller spectrum of the stage in terms of both depth and verticality, in robust steps drawn from ballet and from a social dance vernacular that includes mambo and paso doble. Moreno's performance in the Rooftop America number demonstrates how Anita's choreography consumes the most space, an important feat in a musical preoccupied with the securing and guarding of racialized and gendered turf. The film's Rooftop Song and Dance number America features Anita as the instigator of the gendered debate between the shark men, who voice a sardonic critique of life in America, and the shark women who defend the mainland U.S. as a symbol of modernity, filled with washing machines, skyscrapers, and Cadillacs. Anita's mocking lyrics, Puerto Rico, my heart's devotion, let it sink back in the ocean, launch the song and establish its playful call and undercutting response pattern. Throughout the number, the men and women take turns topping one another through rhymed retorts to each other's claims and through engaging in alternative dance duels. The two groups are thus set in opposition both lyrically and choreographically. Although the men's assertions certainly provide a more accurate reflection of Puerto Rican struggles in America, it is Anita's or Moreno's performance that is more frequently espoused and remembered by Latino audiences. This identification arises, I argue, from the ways that the assimilationist stance of Anita's lyrics are undone, or at least troubled, by Moreno's dancing.
Thank you.
as an aside, part of what motivated me to talk about Rina Moreno was this sort of lingering preoccupation with why, as much as Latinos hate West Side Story, we love it too. And so I think every bit of it has to do with Rina Moreno's performance. So here it goes. See what you think. The choreography for America relies heavily on both ballet and the paso doble, an international Latin ballroom form, danced primarily in competitive rather than social settings. Originating in France, the paso doble stages the stylized march of a Spanish bullfight, wherein the male lead typically portrays the matador, while the female partner in her flowing dress represent his cape, or occasionally the bull to be tamed. Traditionally, the paso doble departs from other ballroom dances by featuring the male rather than the female partner. In the paso doble, the high chest, elongated verticality, and aggressive gestures of the male typically tower over and provide the frame for containing the more flowing movements of his partner. As with the mambo in the gymnasium dance scene, the paso doble functions here in part to project onto the sharps an exotic, ahistorical Latinness. But the particular phrases of the paso doble used here also serve to highlight Moreno's power as a dancer, and subsequently Anita's ability to command space, to literally cover the most ground. And again, in a musical that's totally preoccupied with turf and space, it matters that she takes up so much of it. In America, Moreno enacts her undulating paso doble role with great force, uncontained by Bernardo's or other male sharks' matador-inflected moves. For example, following the lyrics, "Life is all right in America, if you're all white in America," Bernardo and two other shark men launch into a series of paso doble-inspired steps, featuring erect and no doubt homoerotic phallic postures and quick, sharp forward and back and side-to-side movements. They are literally pushed out of the frame by Moreno, who charges toward them with high kicks and sweeping arms. Her solo culminates with Moreno closing in on the men and aggressively shaking the skirt of her dress toward them as if to insist that she is not simply a cape, but in a momentary switching of roles, the bullfighter who wields it. Following this move, she turns away in a strong and graceful kick to signal to the men that this is their cue to resume dancing, and they obey. Unlike the male trio, Moreno dances a solo, suggesting that it takes more than one man to measure up to Anita. Her solo, within the context of a group routine in which no one else is featured dancing alone, reinforces Anita's status, first established in the mambo scene, as simultaneously of the group and apart from it. In a musical preoccupied with belonging and group affiliation, Anita's pronounced singularity is daring. Anita may sing of assimilation, but Moreno's dancing emphasizes that she is ultimately and unabashedly unassimilable. The film's editing underscores Anita's position, both within and apart from this world, by repeatedly showcasing Moreno alone in a shot or in compositions wherein she is framed in opposition to a partnered couple. Even as Bernardo sings his lines, "Everywhere crime in America," the frame features Moreno in the center of its frame. This framing of Anita as a spectacularly singular diva emphasizes her queerness by highlighting her refusal to remain fixed easily within the homogeneous, homosocial world of the female sharks or the strict heterocoupling of partner dances. In this way, Moreno's performance of Anita within America's oral, aural, and kinesthetic borders accomplishes what Lauren Berland calls a, quote, diva turn on citizenship, attempting to transform it from a dead, entirely abstract category of analysis into a live social scene that exudes sparks, has practical consequences, and forces better ways of thinking about nationality, culture, politics, and personhood, end quote. Moreno's dancing transforms the space of national belonging into a spark-filled live social scene in which Anita can occupy a productively ambivalent place in America. Anita's queer diva turns provide a model for inhabiting Latino citizenship in the United States. She is, in fact, queer for Uncle Sam, after all. As a number of Latino scholars observe, Latino approaches to citizenship encourage a rethinking of notions of national belonging precisely because of the ways that Latinos stake their claims to larger U.S. culture while maintaining local, regional, and/or transnational affiliations. Anita's dual positionality, arising from her lyrical and choreographic displays, can aesthetically express the ni de aquí, ni de allá conditions that inform Latino claims of citizenship and belonging, both to larger U.S. culture and to configurations of Latinidad. Central to Moreno's enactment of Anita's diva citizenship is her display of Latina pleasure. No small task, given Jerome Robbins's reputation for a demanding, rigorous adherence to the exacting precision of his choreography. So Jerome Robbins was known to be like extraordinarily disciplinarian in the sort of exactness that he executed from his dancers and his choreography. So driven by the classicism of ballet and influenced by the psychology-delving practices that prevailed in mid-century method acting, Robbins conducted notoriously grueling rehearsals that sought to discipline his performers' bodies into submission. Moreno's deft footwork and polyrhythmic control of her shoulders, torso, and legs clearly demonstrate her mastery of Robbins's choreography. But beyond this exceptional display of discipline, where else might Moreno's kinesthesia or gestural agency emerge? Where might her body betray its complete disciplining to reveal a Latina pleasure? The answer does not lie below the waist, as many are prone to look with Latina bodies, but above the neck. In all of Anita's dance sequences, the camera repeatedly captures Moreno's opened, expressive mouth and playful gaze, focused upon those who surround her, watching her dance. I am taken by Moreno's mouth. In one moment, a widened O of abandon. In the next, pursed with purpose. And in another, lips parted, baring her teeth, always conveying her unrestrained claim to her body. Her open mouth is the flare Moreno releases to signal her presence, her gestural agency, her undisciplined delight, even as she submits to the role of Anita. This sense of Latina pleasure conveyed in Moreno's opened mouth produces something akin to what Alicia Arizón describes as Latina sensualidad, a generative affect or structure of feeling produced by Latina performing bodies. Moreno's ownership of this pleasure is reinforced by her awareness that she is being looked at, by her frequent efforts to look back. Moreno, as Anita, opens her mouth, directs her gaze, and shows Latinas how to retain our right to joy even as we move through antagonistic spaces. Moreno's movements expand the notion of Berlant's diva citizenship to include not simply the diva auratic acts of speaking in public, but the risky kinesthetic acts that reconfigure it. Moreno's performance of Anita offers the critical and courageous gestures for enacting Latina pleasure and sensualidad in the midst of police sexuality, violated bodies, and other tragedies that shape Latino lives. The diva's mouth, as Susan Leonardi and Rebecca Pope observe, is often understood as the locus of her generative and potentially destructive power. They note, quote, the distorting effect of her open mouth, an effect that reinforces the stereotypes of the dangerous diva, the autocratic, the calculating, the devouring diva, the diva vengada. She can eat you up and swallow you whole, they write. We are simultaneously drawn in by and fearful of the cavernous wonder and the mind jewels spilling from the diva's mouth. She gives voice in public to our private longings, desires, and grievances. Every diva, Wayne Kotzenbaum writes, opens her mouth and makes loud sounds. And even if she says, I am for camouflage, she must long ago have given up masks and meekness and decided to disturb the neighbors, end quote. Lena Horne dared to open her diva mouth wide, exposing and disrupting fixed notions of racialized femininity, much to the dismay of show business executives, as an exchange between her and Garland on the Judy Garland Show reveals. So I'm going to just speak through this because the clip I'm going to show you is from another part. But nearing the end of her appearance on the show, Judy Garland turns to her and says, I know why I love to work with you. You open your mouth and sing louder than any other girl singer in the world besides me. And Lena, right? And Lena, in response, says, I know it, and I hate it. Well, I mean, first of all, unless you just open your mouth wide and get a big breath, you can't last as long as some of these arrangements we sing to. And you know, listen, for years I tried to sing pretty because I had an agent when I first came to California, Hollywood, who said, I may find it a little difficult to book you in movies because you just don't look attractive when you sing. And he said, can't you just sort of sing a little pretty when you sing like this? Anyway, but it's impossible, she says. The diva's mouth, as she indicates, is laboring. It delivers. It poses a threat to the gendered order. Not pretty, but sublime. For the black female diva, her open mouth is made all the more threatening because of the ways it is also haunted by the always already entertaining and potentially sinister minstrel mouth, monstrous and desired. The images of horn created by famed caricature artist Al Hirschfeld and more recently by Paul Moisy vividly capture this co-articulation. Horn, like other black female singers, as scholars such as Farrah Jasmine Griffiths, Hazel Carby, and Fred Moten have argued, negotiated these terms that circumscribed the visual and aural spaces she filled. By the time she appeared on the Judy Garland Show, this is a film still from the show, Lena Horne had established herself as a satin-voiced supper club chanteuse in the cabaret circuit and as a pillar singer in a range of movies in which she leaned against a column and sang cameos incidental to the narrative that could easily be excised for the film's circulation in Southern theaters. In his award-winning article, Lena Horne's In Persona, performance scholar Shane Vogel explores Horne's performed aloofness that, quote, renegotiated the fraught intimacies of the cabaret stage, end quote. Vogel considers Horne's aloofness as a studied performance in persona, rather than as an act of racial masquerade or diva haughtiness, that enabled Horne to claim, quote, the psychic space to elaborate a self within the constraints of Jim Crow spectatorial practices, end quote. Understanding Horne's aloofness as a carefully crafted response to white audience demands for intimacy and exposed black female interiority, Vogel notes how Horne's impersona shifted over time. He says, after the transformations of the civil rights movement, Horne's coldness toward her audience thawed and her aloofness took on a different timbre, end quote. Horne's performance on the Judy Garland Show in 1963 signals the beginning of this shift in her career. In her opening duet with Judy Garland on the Johnny Mercer and Ruby Blum standard Day In, Day Out, Horne resists the racial liberalist framing of their staged act and its constructions of racialized femininity. Her rendition of Day In, Day Out instead embodies a searing enactment of everyday life for black subjects seeking citizenship rights in the closing years of the Jim Crow era.
This is the opening of the show. This is the very first thing we see on the show.
Follows me about the same old calling in my heart whenever I think of you.
this is pretty easy. Doesn't take, you know, analytical finesse to figure this one out. As we witnessed, the show begins with the sound of bright horns and a close-up of a long row of white stage lights against a black background. A long pan soon reveals Garland, sauntering downstage along this wall of lights, briefly opening her arms wide to acknowledge and accept her audience's applause before she launches into the song. When she begins, her voice is low, nearly swallowed up by the horns. She clutches her elbows, keeps a tight circumference around her body. As she sings, she widens the circle, but repeatedly returns to this self-enclosed posture, the diva's dialectic, vulnerability, and divinity. Garland builds vocal momentum, and with it a greater gestural expanse, culminating at the song's end with a wide sweep and a rise of her right arm, fingers snapping with the musical shift to a mambo beat that serves to signal Lena Horne's entrance. The wall of lights begins to move as the stage revolves, casting Garland backstage behind it. The backside of the wall appears as a mirror image of the front, endless rows of white bulbs against a black surface. We first see Horne as a shadowy figure emerging into the light alongside the wall. She walks purposefully downstage until she hits her mark. And then time slows. The tempo turns to a languid jazziness. The horns float like the surface of broken water under the vessel of Horne's steady voice. She sings the lyrics, fly taffy, pull through teeth, sweet, agony, the smoker's slow drag. Her body still, eyes flashing, mouth opening in exquisite huffs and puffs, she blows against the lighted walls that frame her. The semiotic and sonic framing of the duet positions the two divas within a well-worn scenario that stages the co-constitutive nature of black and white femininities. This is visually signaled immediately with the focus on the rows and rows of white lights against the black wall. The seemingly endless repetition of the lights suggests that Horne and Garland are entering a scene, to evoke Butler, that was always and already underway upon their arrival. One that demands a reiteration of these circumscribed roles to maintain the status quo. Day in, day out, the performance suggests white femininity must work to maintain itself against its shadow self of blackness. The musical number reveals the workings of this endeavor through the revolving wall that both keeps distinct and simultaneously acts as a hinge between the two women. Garland performs, white satin gleaming, arms conveying a racialized sense of white feminine vulnerability and beckoning, and her act is revealed as not quite whole, but contingent. Horne is thus positioned as the necessary flip side to Garland's embodiment of this ideal. The costuming, too, emphasizes the precariousness of white femininity's stability. Both women are costumed identically in long, white, double-breasted satin trench coats, white gloves, white scarves, white pumps. While this choice may have been guided by the racial liberalist impulse to show equality among the two divas, and may appear at first to work against primitivist notions of racialized sexuality with respect to white femininity, the costuming also suggests the ever-present menacing threat of successful mimicry or masquerade amongst racialized subjects. As the white feminine silhouette fades into darkness, as it must according to the script, the black female body appears in identical dress and in this case outperforms her predecessor. The dialectical construction of racialized femininity is not just signaled visually, but sonically as well. Even before the lighted wall begins to move, the horns wail and the drums sound. 1,000 drums, the song insists, measuring out the quick, quick, slow beat of the mambo. Horn's appearance is thus sounded within the aural register of the sexualized spectacle of the mulatta, not so black after all, but availably Latinized. The sonic cue underscores the ways that Jim Crow's spectatorial practices had conditioned audiences to consume Lena Horne as a light-skinned singer of popular standards in the cabaret circuit, and shows also the slippage between dominant notions of black and Latina sexuality that serve to bolster ideals of white femininity. Or more specifically, it shows how Latina sexuality was used as a way to contain the possible threat of black female sexuality in the service of whiteness. And yet, Lena Horne's rendition of Day In, Day Out strains against these reins. She drags herself through it. Her voice moves us to a different tempo, creates a temporal space beyond the present. She holds things up, moves them in another direction. She refuses to move to the beat, beat, beat of the tom-toms. Instead, she walks purposefully downstage, the smile on her lips abruptly twisted into a sneer as she sings with near languor, day in, day out, the same old hoodoo follows me about. Horn exploits the pronounced downshift in arrangement from Garland's version by transforming the upbeat love song into a matter-of-fact statement of struggle and survival for Black Americans. Her body remains resolutely still, no welcoming or guarded arms. Her eyes narrow and flare, and her mouth, oh, her mouth, opens to bare her teeth with contempt on the end words or emphasized syllables of each phrase. The costume that covers nearly all of her body except her face, combined with the camera's close-up shots, further emphasize the complex workings of Horn's facial expressions. Through the alchemy of Horn's mouth, the same old hoodoo is transformed from a lover's obsession into a reference to the same old racist shit endured, withstood. Her propulsive and literally low-key phrasing on the same old pounding in my heart whenever I think of you, and darling, I think of you, suggests a warning rather than a plea, as if to say, watch your back, I'm making my plans for you. She fills her mouth with air, her cheek a small round bomb, and puffs out on the word pounding. She huffs and she puffs, the smoker's slow drag. She drags herself through it. She drags herself. That is, she appears in moments, especially when singing alternating lyrics with Garland in the number's last section, to be performing herself, in quotations, performing the awareness of herself performing. Shane Vogel notes that in her cabaret performances during the 40s, Horn engaged in a protective strategy of Brechtian third-person singing by disarticulating herself from her song. But what distinguishes Horn's appearance on the Judy Garland show from her earlier cabaret performances is that she does not remain within this space of dispassionate and critically distanced aloofness. She offers her audience neither simply an alienated restraint nor a diva's generosity, but a controlled ferocity, a conscious and cultivated stance invariably shaped by recent tragedies in the struggle for civil rights. A month before the show's taping, after witnessing news footage of hoses turned violently at Bull Connor's orders upon Black student protesters in Birmingham, Horn had accepted Medgar Evers' invitation to participate in a civil rights rally in Jackson, Mississippi on June 7th. Tremendously moved by the experience, she later recounted, quote, "It was the first time I believed I had any talent at all. I cried for the first time in many years," end quote. On the morning of June 12, 1963, just several days later, Horn was waiting in the green room at the NBC studio before her scheduled appearance on the Today Show when she received the news that Evers had been murdered. Joined by prominent civil rights leader Roy Wilkins, Horn proceeded with the interview in which she proclaimed Medgar Evers, quote, "a casualty in what to me now seems to be a war. We are fighting a moral war. And that my life would be touched by his only inspires me to try not to hate." She lets out a sarcastic laugh. "And to try to be purposeful in the kind of battle I think we have to wage." On June 21st, she returned to Jackson for an NAACP rally in Evers' honor, where she sang, "We Shall Overcome." This experience was transformational for Horn, who later said that the event marked a, quote, "personal reawakening" and inaugurated for her a whole year of crying. A month later, Horn joined Garland for the show's taping. Her performance in the opening duet is propelled by an undercurrent of this purposeful rage and sorrow. What is striking about the routine is the ways that it upends the traditional conventions of the duet form itself. The number is launched with each diva staging her own version of the song rather than taking turns volleying verses. It is, in fact, a song not especially suited to the duet exchange, as it does not have many verses, and lyrically chronicles a seemingly unidirectional lover's obsession. Horn's performance of the song further estranges it from the intimate and playful pressures of duet conventions. Once Horn completes her contrasting rendition of the song, the music returns to its up-tempo charge and Garland approaches, face upturned as she sings to Horn, "When I Awake." Horn does not return the stance. Instead, continues to face the audience directly while joining in with Garland, who has linked arms with Horn on "I Awaken with a Tingle." Horn maintains this posture of refusal as the music shifts once again and the women launch into the opening verse from another song, actually, from Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer's standard, "Come Rain or Come Shine." Horn drops her arms, garland is still clinging, and leads them further downstage, closer to the audience, as she sings, "Come Rain," the phrase resounding as a Prospero-issued command rather than a conditional statement. Garland is assigned what is normally the first line of the song's verse, "I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you." But set in response to Horn's assertion, the line only reinforces Garland's air of neediness in contrast to Horn's staged refusals. When Horn counters with "Come Shine," her hand gesture, fingers pressed together, then extended, is not affectionate, but combative, rendering shine into shiner. And in the next verse, her mouth curls into a snarl on the shared line, "Then I kiss your lips." Horn thus refuses throughout to enter into the hermetic circuit of the duet with Garland. And while this exchange may be disregarded as simply the result of Horn's well-documented frustration during the show's rehearsal process, Horn's performance is not reducible to her antipathy towards Garland. Within the context of the losses and gains for civil rights that shaped this historical moment, Horn's refusal to seem pretty, to play nice with the white girl, announces her allegiance in what she calls the moral war that has beset the nation. Horn's wide-opened mouth, contorted with contempt, while spilling silken notes through parted lips, emerges here as a synecdoche for the movement's struggles and triumphs, the ocean's roar, a thousand drums. The diva's mouth is the velvet-lined robe we want to enter, the velvet rope that keeps us out. And it is not velvet at all. It is coarse. It charts a course. It veers. In the closing moments of their duet, Garland and Horn each improvise a line, following the lyric, and the pounding becomes an ocean's roar, a thousand drums. Garland sings, "And so much more." Horn follows with a growl, "Yeah, here it comes." And her words are a proclamation, not of love, but of war. Here, her voice, its timbre and content, not only anticipates, but instantiates a moment of diva citizenship. As Lauren Berlant writes, "Flashing up and startling the public, the diva citizen puts the dominant story into suspended animation." A month after the Judy Garland show taping, Horn joined thousands, including Rita Moreno, at the March on Washington, where she appeared briefly at the podium. She did not sing, but simply spoke one word, attenuated with struggle and yearning and resilience. "Freedom," she roared, a flare, a threat, a loud disturbance to the neighbors, a diva citizen's battle cry. Thank you. I'm happy to take questions or get feedback. I'm sort of hungry for it, so. Absolutely. I think that part of what I was, excited about with this particular performance is the way that she, because of her light skin and the way that she is, you know, positioned, whether it's through the mambo horns, which can then like sort of say, see, look, she's, you know, she's mulatta, she's, you know, for our, you know, kind of consuming in that way. I think that, the way that she, it also works, I think, her skin to kind of further emphasize the threat of the kind of mimicry that happens with the costuming. So I think it actually serves here to serve to be more of a threat, ironically, than because of the proximity. You know, the way that proximity is working here, I think, is interesting. But I do think what's interesting for me here is this moment, which I think is happening at a time in her career when it's just, this shift is beginning to happen in her performance persona, where she's really trying to sort of push against the constraints in a different way about the way that she's consumable because of her light skin. So she's trying to sort of, I think, enact different performance strategies to sort of show, look, this body that you see that may seem less threatening is actually trying to sort of exert herself as a little more threatening. You know, even in this moment, she's already sort of going, I'm not really down with King, I'm down with Malcolm X. You know, so she's trying to find ways to sort of push against the ways that her skin and you know, the particular kind of beauty that she was kind of constructed as had. She was trying, I think, find different ways to push against it.
And that's why I think it's so remarkable, so lovely what you do with her mouth in particular, mm-hmm. and the menstrual pitches, because I wonder if it does become possible to think about the performance, her performance of the mouth, as another way of thinking about how she's trying to fight against the way that people are reading so much into that light skin.
Yeah, and I think you're right that there's a way that, you know, she, her horn in particular shows both, I think, the spectrum of ways that, you know, the black female body enacts that threat while being so, you know, desired and consumable. Like, she's sort of doing, I think she's an example that shows both of those things happening. Yeah, thanks, that's really helpful. Yes?
First of all, thank you for the really great presentation. Secondly, towards the end, I mean, you ended with Lena Horne and freedom, right? To point towards the relationship between her performance and her radicality of politics. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering whether Rita Moreno could, is there something similar that could be said about Rita Moreno's performance of La Dignidad vis-a-vis a radical politics? You
can
compare that to, for example.
Mm-hmm. Sure. One of the things that I talk about in a larger version of the Rita Moreno section is that there's a couple things. One, she is almost immediately after this pretty vocal in public about the constraints put on her as an actress. In fact, she did not work in film for 6 years after West Side Story because all she got offered were sort of gang girlfriend roles, and she was sort of very public about that. But the other thing I talk about is Anita as a character is really interesting because she's the one who ultimately delivers the line in the musical that said that she lies basically and says to the Jets, you know, actually Maria's killed herself, right? And it's actually her lie that then sets forth the tragedy and sort of makes the plague on both their houses, so to speak. And I think her discursive power there actually sort of can signal for us a kind of radical politics around, like, you know what? This world needs to be destroyed as we know it. And Anita's the only figure at the end of West Side Story who's actually not featured on stage at the end. She's literally unassimilated. She's literally not incorporated to this world of hate. And I think by having that kind of distinctly separate and separatist kind of stance discursively and narratively, it can do something, it can suggest something similar. So Anita, I think, combined with Moreno might do that work. Yeah. Thanks for that question. That's great. Others? Yes.
Sort of a footnote on the performance of day in and day out, the contrast that you so beautifully make between those two interpretations of the song. I mean, the song, you know, Johnny Mercer, who wrote the lyric, was mm-hmm. madly in love with Judy Garland.
Yes.
And probably was thinking of her when he wrote that when he wrote that lyric. And so it has a kind of built-in personal dimension, a kind of intensely personal and even autobiographical dimension when she's singing it, which of course gets completely revised and transformed when Horne sings it.
That's lovely. I actually had totally forgotten about that. I think that, you know, there is a way that, you know, I find Garland's vulnerability here, you know, so, I mean, I think Garland in general, the sort of performed vulnerability and her star text around her fragility and her struggles, I think are so important. And so having this be like, okay, here's this song about how someone's so in love with me, you know, it's sort of negotiating, but it's displaying both of those, like, yes, I am adored, and look, I'm like clinging needily to all my guests, you know, so it's like never enough, you know. I think that's really, I think, interesting, and captures that dialectic that I was sort of mentioning around vulnerability and divinity. Thanks, that's useful. Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of Rita Moreno's kind of post West Side Story career, because as you said, she became quite vocal and critical about the sorts of roles that were offered, and I couldn't help but think about sort of scenes in Zoot Suit as we're watching them dance, you know, the kind of homoerotics of Zoot Suit. And when there isn't a figure like Anita in Zoot Suit.
There's no, I know.
And so there's a way in which the sort of film-ishness continues to kind of exclude Anita. And yet Moreno really found ways to articulate interesting critiques. I think about that sort of scene on Sesame Street where she's...
Oh, it's such a great scene. Yeah, you could, there's a whole other paper about the two of them, on, you know, each of them individually on Sesame Street.
Right.
Yeah.
So I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about the course of that, and she's still quite vocal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that part of it's, you know, it's in many ways part of what I think continued probably to propel, in addition from her virtuosic performance in the film itself, I think her consistent... enactment of these critiques throughout time just kept Latino audiences even more, I think, cathecting with Anita, right? One, because there weren't any other representations, right? There isn't in Zoot Suit, she's not, right? And there isn't an Anita, I think, an equivalent, for a long time, if since. And so there's that sort of absence of representation, but there's also her sort of, star text in the sense that she's this person, we can hear her critiques of it even as we're taking pleasure in it. But I think that she was able, I think that, how exactly, part of that is she was one of the few actresses who were brown who were getting roles, but even her work in Oz or her work in on Law and Order, the Vincent D'Onofrio Law and Order, I can't remember what it's called. Yeah, I think she brings a kind of gravitas, like there's a way that her performances bring its kind of own, she does a little bit of that third person thing, she brings a kind of gravitas and a kind of resistance to simply the accent, she exceeds accent literally here, like I think that even in her performance here, there's a kind of, I am going to so overdo the accent that you see that I'm commenting on it. So she, but and later in her career, she'll just try, I think, in many ways to push against it entirely. So I think some of that informs how we look back at this particular performance too, as Latinos who are so troubled by it and yet delighting in it.
So are you suggesting that there's a kind of parallel production between her pushing back against accent and ways in which Horn is kind of thinking about skin color?
I think a little bit, I would say that. I mean, I think that, it might manifest itself differently because I think with Moreno, she's definitely doing this kind of performance of, like, exaggeration and excess. And Horn, I think, is just trying to, perform a particular, if not exaggeration, a particular kind of performed rage that gets located and distilled in the mouth, whereas for Moreno, you could say maybe it's the voice more than simply the mouth. Yeah, that's helpful. Thank you. As I think through it, I'm so eager, like I said, to get more feedback and to just be told, yeah, I don't buy it, or you need more. I'm just like, this is where I am in the project, so thank you. Yeah. Oh, hey.
It's not my field, so maybe this is well known, but I thought I had heard that Maria, who was not Latina, had to sort of learn this accent. And sort of that one of the sort of issues was that Rita Moreno had to be like this figure that she would embody, right? Sort of copy in some extent. And so I feel like somewhere I had read that the overplaying the accent and the, I guess to some extent even the performance, could be read as an act of resistance in that kind of relationship. That here was this young woman that somehow I have to train to be Latina, who's not Latina, in this kind of way that's offensive, right? If I am the Latina.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, definitely it was well known, there was no way that Moreno could have been the Anita figure, right? Because, of course, just miscegenation, oh my God, if they're going to even suggest it, the body at least has to be a white one, although they were all made up in brown face. So, that's interesting in and of itself. But I think that, the knowledge around her having to sort of mentor or teach someone to do that, I think also shows the very constructiveness of the Spitfire image itself, right? Having to then teach someone to do it means that it is clearly, not stable. useful. Yeah?
To start bringing you back to Selena.
Sure. They always do. I try to get out and they just pull me back in.
So, a few months ago, I was on YouTube and I was looking for A Boy Like That. The song was, originally I thought it comes from Selena, the soundtrack, the movie. I had no idea that it was actually part of this movie. Okay? So, is there a relationship between Selena's diva status and Selena's, the public's obsession with Selena's mouth, particularly, mm-hmm. right? Selena, I remember growing up, my parents and family would like compare Selena to, say, La Flaca from Gloria Estefan, Gloria mm-hmm. Estefan's niece. Can't remember her name.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about, right? So, this obsession between the Latina's mouth as a sign of her diva status and her celebrity status, mm-hmm. But also as a sign of, like, that is a marker of what makes her this ethnic star, right? Mm-hmm. Or a star for ethnic subjects, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to think about how is it that, or can it be related to Selena's diva marketing, or the marketing of Selena as a diva post-mortem, to what you're arguing here in terms of the power of the sensuality, the not only the erotics, but the politics behind the performers, the female performers' mouth.
Sure. So a couple things. One, I think that Anita's sort of, or the role of West Side Story for Latino communities is so exemplified in the very fact that you know that there's the album of, like, you know, all the Latina stars and Latino stars performing songs from West Side Story. So Selena, as part of that album, performs A Boy Like That, right? So it's from an album that was released in which Latino performers perform West Side Story, right? So there's this, you know, there's this we love it and we hate it, you know, enactment in the very sort of issuing of the album. But I think it also her doing that also served to bolster her status as a Latina diva, right? Like, I've performed Moreno / Anita, therefore now I can be in the pantheon. So there's that happening. And I think with Selena, it may be not simply just the mouth, but similarly to with, I think, Moreno, but the voice, like that she was able to capture that kind of tear in the voice sound of rancheras and other things that then, despite her young age, that then allowed her to sort of enter into a kind of status that you know that meant that sort of authenticated her, right, as, you know, Mexicana, or, you know, as Mexicana enough despite the fact that she was totally pocha and totally not, you know, couldn't speak Spanish or spoke it like I do, which is like a Tejana. So, you know, I think that there was the sound of her voice, I think, that definitely figured in here. I haven't thought much about how the mouth might work with Selena, but I will think about it. Yeah. Yes.
Hi. Thank you again so much for this wonderful presentation. And I'm going to ask you a question that I would hate to answer myself. But I'm going to ask you to kind of think about sort of contemporary representations of mulatto diva type figures. And I'm thinking of, like, Mariah Carey and Beyonce Knowles. And perhaps, I'm not sure if you're even familiar with, I mean, it's kind of hard to miss them, but I think what's most useful about your diva citizenship, or I think you've also, or defiant citizenship, mm-hmm. the kind of subversive power that these women embody, mm-hmm. and the politics attached to that, how do you see that either not being reiterated, or what could you think of ways, or how would you respond to sort of more contemporary representations of this kind of mulatto?
Sure.
Sure,
absolutely. It's hard to miss Beyonce, and I saw her in concert, and I was, I mean, that's actually, she's just a stunning performer in it live. It's really remarkable. And I would say that it is really, I think, important to acknowledge the ways that particular kind of mulatta construct is so pernicious, right? You know, there's a reason Halle Berry thanks Lena Horne when she accepts her Oscar, right? I mean, she is totally, and in ways that are infuriating, you know, especially that she won for Monster's Ball, which just, like, sickens me. But I think that, like, that is, in fact, the fantasy, right? That she is sexually available and, in fact, you know, once we have her, can be completely wild but containable and, you know, cover girl pretty as opposed to, you know, MAC makeup pretty, right, or something, right, even. So I think that these women are certainly still operating within those very strict confines still. I think what's really interesting, and I would go back always as a performance scholar, to think about, let's say with Beyoncé, one, her attempt to own her means of production, right, that I think then creates, you know, her attempt to kind of create her brand, right? I mean, we could look to that, those kind of moments. We could look to the actual, her ability to, her choreographic virtuosity, like I talk about here, I think it may show also moments where they may be trying to, at moments, exploit and at moments comment on that particular kind of mulatta construction of sexuality. The fact, for example, that she won't talk about her and Jay-Z, like, off camera, right? That there's certain spaces that she's just kind of cordoned off, like, you will not have access. I think that might matter, even as she is completely kind of, you know, in that machine in some ways, both that she, in ways she participates, but in ways that she doesn't. So I think that I would say with her that she's still operating within it, but that there are moments that we can look to. Even her, I mean, if we think about the Single Ladies video, and we think about the ways that, you know, all the brouhaha about it being the kind of restaging of, what's her name's, the court, the piece from the 1960s, I can't remember who it was, like, who choreographed it, but the name is completely escaping me. But even thinking of the kind of, the threat of that is that she did it so well, right, that she, in fact, if we think about, like, mimicry and the menace of that, ooh, you know, she actually did it spectacularly. So I would say that those are moments where we could look to, as a performance scholar, I'm always interested in, like, where in the performances do we see that kind of pushback, even if it's totally provisional, even if it's momentary. I think that she is someone who I see, I think, doing it in ways that are, to me, more interesting than, say, Halle Berry. That's my take. That she's attempting it at all.
Let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you all very much.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.